I do believe that disclosure will trigger very possibly the greatest era of reform in history. In other words, it's going to create a kind of a cascading effect in which, because of the fact that the world's attention will suddenly be focused pretty much in the same direction, through billions of eyes focusing in the same direction, and that everything sort of is tossed up in the air, everything goes on the table suddenly, which happens once in a while, that the reformist movements that are out there, and there's reformist movements everything, right? You just don't hear about them, but they're out there struggling along, working out of their basements, will suddenly be given life and energy and money. And you're going to see literally a systemic, I think, spectral reform that will be staggering in its size and scope. Now, will it lead us to wonderful things? Will it all work out? Will it be like the French Revolution? You start off with a good idea, the next thing you know, you're lopping heads. I don't know. But I know that the opportunity is there. And for me, that's one of the reasons to keep going and do this. It's not just, they'll tell us the ETs are here. We have a world that has basically been shoving stuff under the rug for a couple of centuries, putting things in the closet, sticking them in the attic, not taking care of business, not dealing with what has to be done. And that was going to catch up with us. And I think this is the trigger that suddenly says, okay, we got to clean out the basement, clean out the attic. We got to cut the lawn. We got to take care of business. We got to clean up the secret empire. We got to start filming the Bilderberg meeting. We got to toss the Skull and Bones idiots off the Yale campus. We got to do a lot of things. We need monetary reform. We need doctrine reform in the Christian church, the Islamic faith. We got to take care of stuff because a lot of stuff is stupid, right? It's ridiculous. But we're locked up. After the last 2,000 years, we're just completely all locked up. We can't move. And so you go to the Congress for some simple thing, and the Congress is going, I can't move. And you go to the Islamic faith and say, look, we need a little change here. We're going to have a world class. We can't act. Catholic Church can't change its policy on birth control. We can't get anything done. All of a sudden, boom, into this comes the biggest event of all time. So what happens after that's up to us. I just look as my job is trying to help people look and see and maybe be part of the post-disclosure world. But we've hopefully earned our right to be on the stage. Hopefully we've earned the right.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and I would like to let everyone know that if you've not been to GalacticConnection.com, please do. Please check out our daily blog page. We are available 365 days a year, folks. Get that. And we provide information on everything from conspiracy to spirituality to ufology to quantum physics. Anything that's really allowing people to jump down that rabbit hole and expand your consciousness, because that's what it's all about, is really getting out of our boxes and being open to possible first contact. So today's radio show is for the date of April 7th, 2015. And I really am excited about this interview. I think because I've been asking for this for a long time. As many of you know, I am very, very high and very keen to get out the message about us being prepared for the new Galactic Society and being prepared that we will be working amongst other extraterrestrials, which we know are already walking this planet as we speak. So who better to bring some information forth than Stephen Bassett? And he has an amazing background. I'm just going to give kind of the short version, Stephen. Stephen Bassett is a leading advocate for ending the 68 years, folks, government-imposed truth embargo regarding an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. He's a political activist, lobbyist, commentator, degreed in physics, and an executive director of Paradigm Research Group. He's also the executive producer of X Conference And of course, many of you are very well versed on the citizen hearings on disclosure, and he is the main man behind that project. He's also part of the Congressional Hearing Initiative, and he'll talk to us a little bit about that. His work has been covering extensively on a national and international level within the media. He really, truly is someone we all should follow in regards to the information that he's bringing forth today. Since 1996, Bassett has assisted numerous organizations and initiatives working for, number one, raising public awareness of both the extraterrestrial presence and the truth embargo. Number two, convening open congressional hearings to take government and agency witnesses' testimonies. And number three, inciting the political media to appropriately cover the attendant issues. He has appeared on over 1,200 radio shows, my God, Stephen, how you do it, and talk shows, and numerous documentaries speaking to millions of people across the world about the implications and the likelihood, and in what I would say the definite hood, of disclosure, the formal acknowledgement that extraterrestrials are present, do exist, by world governments. So with that said, wow, that is that's an amazing resume there, Stephen.
So thank you. I could have done a lot more in those 18 years, but I watch way too much television.
Well, you know, what I want to start out with is I think it's very interesting in some of the information I've reviewed regarding all of your other interviews. You've talked very poignantly about the difference between UFO contact and truth embargo. Can you clarify that a little bit as far as changing the verbiage and the vernacular and using, ET contact or UFO disclosure? You really UFO. Like the word UFO.
UFO cover-up, yes.
Cover-up, yes.
One of the things that has to happen in most advocacy is you need to create your own language so that people will have the proper understanding of what you're doing. Oftentimes you're advocating against the government, and what happens is you don't want to use the government's language, you want to use your language.
Good point.
UFO is a term that I believe lost its usefulness no later than 1992. Cover-up is a misnomer because the policy to withhold this acknowledgement of this issue, to contain this issue by the government, which dates all the way back to the late 40s, was in fact a national security policy and was completely legal. And you can't cover up an illegal policy. And so in order to not offend the government any more than necessary, I started pushing the term truth embargo around 2001, maybe, I forget. And I'm pleased that you hear it more and more and more in UFO cover up less and less. That is the difference. It's not UFO, it's extraterrestrial craft. It's not politics, it's actually exopolitics. It's not cover-up, it's embargo. And disclosure is a capital D, meaning the acknowledgement event, the day that the head of state acknowledges the ET presence. That's capital D disclosure.
Okay.
These are just some of the terms that are increasingly used, which truly reflect what we're trying to do.
It's awesome to... Well, that's very educational for all of us because I think we're still all using, the UFO vernacular rather than the truth embargo.
It's not going away easily.
It's very difficult.
It's been around a long time, so it's not going away easily. I get that.
So one of the other things was I was very surprised to hear you talk about the actual downed craft in 1947 in Roswell as not being the typical round saucer. It was actually a different vehicle. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, that was really surprising to me.
The witnesses testify to this. You can see examples of this craft. They're not perfect because we don't have a photograph. It's from multiple witness accounts, but it was a Chevron craft, semi-aerodynamic. Which tells you right away that it's probably not as sophisticated as the saucers.
Interesting.
That are particularly common. And also the entities, the bodies, and the one living entity that was recovered from that crash. When you look at the witness accounts as drawn by various artists, they are not the grace. In fact, it's virtually never not been seen hardly at all, I guess, since. And this is interesting. I believe, and I'm speculating here, that this particular group was also around, and things started to heat up very quickly in 47 because other groups were making significant changes in their engagement protocol. And things got very intense, and this group really was over its head. It was time for it to step away. In other words, they were playing double-A ball, and the major league game was about to start. And so either because of something we did, but more likely a massive thunderstorm that took place over Roswell in early July. I've actually been in a thunderstorm in Roswell, 1997, and it was like the end of the world.
Oh, my God.
It was really impressive. We think two of them smacked together and crashed.
What?
And it may be there were other entities who needed to leave town when the main group decided to change the level of engagement here in 47. This is my interpretation.
Sure.
No, can't prove it, but the craft was not a saucer.
Okay, well, are you aware of what species was actually part of this crash?
I'm sure there are channel people that will tell you what their name is, where they came from, and what they eat for breakfast. I don't.
Okay, I'm just curious. And the other thing that was interesting is why you thought the Vietnam War was actually triggered. Can you go over that a little bit, the boats in the ocean regarding Korea?
Oh.
That's another new piece of information for me.
Well, that's because you have a few less years on your automobile than I do. I don't talk about my personal politics too much. And I'll try to couch this in nonpartisan terms, but to me, the path of the United States through the 20th century was significantly diverted by a very key event that occurred in 1964. And it was a supposed attack on our destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin, off of North Korea. And based upon this, quote, attack, unquote, Johnson slammed through the Congress in 24 hours a resolution calling for an escalation of the war in Vietnam. Later it proved that that attack was not what they said it was. It was a lie. Amazing. Later we learned that they knew it was a lie. And so the Gulf of Tonkin resolution essentially allowed the war in Vietnam to be profoundly escalated based on a lie, which in fact happens very frequently. And from that point forward, I believe the fortunes of the United States have been in decline.
Wow.
So look it up. Google Gulf of Tonkin, T-O-N-K-I-N, a resolution, and you will learn quite a bit.
Thank you for that. Now, obviously, everybody's so familiar with your work with the citizens' hearings. And you did one in 2001, right? And 2013?
No.
No?
2001 was the Disclosure Project's press conference, the National Press Club, in the main ballroom, a significant event in which 18 witnesses came in to speak briefly before 100 members of the press. They were military agency political witnesses is what they were. And another 70 perhaps were presented to the media in a four-hour condensed video, I think from like 100 hours of interviews. And this was a very significant event. I was there. I helped a little bit in putting together. It was the Disclosure Project's event, press conference. And I know for a fact that the media was definitely sniffing around after this. And there was a significant potential for more interviews, for witnesses to start getting some attention, media attention, and so forth. And it could have been a game changer. Unfortunately, and this happens more often than you might think, history intervened.
So the 2013, are you feeling it was because it wasn't in front of the press?
Oh, no. Hang on.
Okay.
you got two different animals here. But the 2001 press conference by the Disclosure Project did not achieve what it set out to do, because only 4 months later was 9/11.
Right.
The advocacy movement, the truth advocacy movement on ET issue, was flattened. All right? It was a massive setback. Now, starting in 2004, I started holding X conferences in the Washington area. This was PRG's way to try to keep some of these witnesses involved. Since some witnesses, some of the military agency political witnesses participated in these X conferences, there were six of them, right? And they were held in 2004, 2005, 7, 8, 9, and 10, right? All good, right? But in 2013 was what I consider, and what many people consider, perhaps the most important event
yes.
in history of this phenomenon, and that was the citizen hearing on disclosure.
Yes.
Now, it was also held in the main ballroom of the National Press Club, approximately almost 12 years to the day that the Disclosure Project press conference was held. Only this wasn't a press conference, this was a mock congressional hearing. Citizen hearing on disclosure. And we brought 42 witnesses in from 10 countries to testify for 30 hours over 5 days before six former members of Congress in a mock hearing setting with audience, press area, filmed everything, webcasted to the world.
Right? Okay.
And it went extremely well. And the six former members of Congress were very impressed. And that cost a lot of money. It cost over $700,000 to put that on. And that money was contributed by a advanced thinking Canadian.
Wow, one? One person?
One person.
Wow. Thank you, whoever you are.
And I'm not surprised. I had originally put the idea out for a citizen hearing in 2001. Could not raise the money. Could not find an American to fund it. And initially, the budget was around $300,000. The money came from a Canadian, and that is not surprising, because the Canadians are far less intimidated by the government, far less afraid of it. They have not been inundated with the truth embargo propaganda to the degree that Americans have. And so this gentleman, who is just a very advanced thinking person, who had some money that he could spare.
That's fantastic. Can
you government deal with PRG, or with a new partnership.
I was wondering, could you clarify, because this is something that people don't have a super clear line on, and that is, how did you go through the selection process of bringing the actual former members forward from Congress?
It was not easy.
There's a couple different stories out there, so.
It was not easy. I had certain ones that I thought I had a shot at, and I started to approach them. And the word sort of got around. I think I got a couple of referrals. We signed up one person. We had a second one that looked real good. But that person couldn't commit. Time went on. And it was getting really dicey. And then somebody stepped in, very important ally of PRG and a major supporter of PRG, Dr. Joseph Buchman. A PhD in economics, libertarian party member, and active. You know, I think he was actually chairman of their platform committee at one point. He had a lot of political connections, and he got on the phone, and he got some members interested, people that he was referred to or indirectly referred to, and very quickly. But he also informed me that the amount of money that I was suggesting for a full week from a former member was simply inadequate. And so we increased it substantially, and it clicked. And very quickly, we had five. We were going to stop there. But then Roscoe Bartlett, a 20-year member of Congress, PhD in science, became available. And so I added him. I had to do it. And that's how it came about. I mean, they were paid, but that wasn't the only reason they were there. They clearly were interested. But none of them were selected on the basis of views they had about the ET issue. It was never even asked.
And it wasn't based on donations, right? It wasn't based on money or anything like that, because that's another rumor that's going around.
Okay, you don't ask a former member of Congress to come and spend a full week and put in 8 hours a day for 5 days in a hearing and think, oh, they'll just do it. What? I don't think so. Most of these six members get $15,000 to $20,000 for just a single speech that might last an hour and a half to 2 hours. And so they were paid, and just like they were paid when they were in the Congress. So certainly that helped to do it. Without that payment, I could not have put together a committee. But that should not shock or surprise anyone.
Fantastic. And that's just to clarify for the audience, that was Representative Carolyn Kilpatrick, former Representative Merrill Cook, former Senator Mike Gravel, former Representative Roscoe Bartlett, and who were there, two others?
Darlene Hooley. And then Roscoe Bartlett, which I mentioned. Okay. So we had five members, one former senator, three Democrats, two Republicans, and a Libertarian, three women, three men, 80 years of total tenure between them. Very, very representative committee.
Very balanced. That's fantastic. So now I know you've been asked this a gazillion times, Stephen, but let's just do it again.
Either gazillion or bazillion.
I mean, I know most of the encounters date back to the 1950s, and the typical reason for the alleged cover-up is the Russians, you know, not wanting the Russians to get their hands on the alien technology. And I'm just wondering, can you review with the audience the complexities of why the U.S. government and the military complex are still covering this up today?
This is a short answer.
Okay.
Summing up a five-hour answer.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Here is the speed slideshow. All right, on that. United States cracks the atom, builds atomic bombs, drops them on civilians in Japan, late 1995, then proceeds to begin a bomb building program and, of course, develop a hydrogen bomb, which we were well on the way to by early 1947. In early 1947, extraterrestrial engagement dramatically increased. No question they were around before then. They may have been around for the last 10,000 years or longer. But whatever they were doing prior to early 1947, they went hyperbolic. Sightings all over the world, including the legendary Mount Rainier sighting by the pilot Kenneth Arnold. Only a couple of weeks after that is when the crash at Roswell takes place, and we almost had disclosure in July of 1947, right? Whatever the government may have suspected or known prior to Roswell, and I think they knew a lot, based on the Foo Fighter events and a possible crash vehicle even prior to the war, but whatever, there was nothing known in the public about it. The government very closely held, very limited. So the real eye-opener comes with the Roswell crash. And in the aftermath of the Roswell crash, they formed a committee, which has come to be known as Magic 12, Majestic 12. I don't care what it was named. Very well likely it was Majestic 12, but whatever, they formed it.
That's a good point.
And to deal with the issue, right? The truth embargo was not really underway at that point, other than they weren't telling anybody, but they didn't have a program. But they were certainly trying to decide what to do about this. And as of late 1947, the government knew these things. There were extraterrestrials here. They had a crash vehicle with unknown technology, right? They did not know their agenda. They did not know a lot about them. They certainly did not know what this technology could produce. They also know that the Soviets were working on an atomic bomb that they would test very soon. They also know that the Soviets had the hydrogen bomb secrets and would undoubtedly work to develop one of those. They knew there was an Iron Curtain across Europe. They knew that they were in a very confrontational situation that would likely, as history has dramatically shown, lead to the next war. And that war would be nuclear and would be, well, it would make World War II look like a garden party. So they had a serious plate full of issues to address. And naturally, they were not eager to simply just tell the public, right? They had no idea what the consequences would be. And so until they understood more, until they knew where things were going to go with the Soviet Union, they just said, we're going to sit tight on this. And that's what they did. They sort of just sort of sat tight on it through 48, 49, 50, 51. There were sightings and there was stuff happening, but it seemed like it was under control. And then in July of 1952, E.T. craft turned up over Washington for several days and scared the living daylights out of the government because there was nothing they could do about it. And that meant that these E.T.s, whatever their intentions, were more than happy to push this issue, to push their presence. So in late 1952, they convened a secret CIA panel that came to be called the Robertson Panel to, quote, decide what the hell to do about it. Years later, we got a copy of the Robertson Report. Basically, what that report concluded was this. After 5 years of dealing with this phenomenon, it did not appear that it was a direct threat to the American people. What was a threat was the awareness of this issue by the American people. And therefore, they needed to deal with the awareness. And shortly after that, they really got serious about a full truth embargo. The intention, I'm sure, was, okay, look, we're embargoing this. We're going to do whatever we have to do. Misinformation, disinformation, threaten witnesses, threaten researchers, co-opt the media, which they'd already done to some degree already, but they were going to get serious about it. Right? And then we'll see where things go. Perhaps in 5 or 10 years, things will be settled down with the Soviet Union. Circumstances will be this or that, whatever. What they didn't know, they couldn't have was that, no, we wouldn't have a nuclear war, though we almost did on a few occasions. But the Cold War, the standoff, would last for 44 years, cost $15, $16, $18 trillion, depending upon how you want to count. And there was no way that they were going to simply announce the extraterrestrial presence with, by 1980, 70-some thousand nuclear weapons archived in 7 countries, with thousands of them on immediate launch capability, which, as the scientists had appropriately pointed out, would essentially launch a nuclear winter and end most of large life on the planet. They were not going to divorce. So by the time the Cold War was fully ended in 1992, the truth embargo was fully institutionalized. It was in the political propaganda worldview DNA of the American people and the press. And so there was a 44-year history behind it, and nobody was particularly enthusiastic about being the first one to go out there and say, you know, guess what? And so they started to dance with this issue. Now, a lot has happened in the last 22 years that we know about that generally explains why, to this day, they haven't made the announcement. And I could spend a very long time going into that. But, you know, I got tons of lectures on YouTube. Go find them. You'll hear me talking about that. So that is the answer. But the punchline is that the truth embargo is almost over. And I believe it could end this year and even this summer.
Yeah, I'm coming to that question first.
Well, I'm sure you are.
So, you know that there were a bunch of FBI documents that were released.
FBI documents, sir.
And they were indicating that the Roswell event was due to the downing of an ET vehicle by an electromagnetic system that was hidden within a radar dome.
That's possible. And it might have been the combination of the radar system that we were using and the lightning storm. Okay. Again, even though I do not believe the ETs at Roswell were as advanced as the ones we generally know about, they're still advanced.
Yes.
And it might have been a combination of this tremendous lightning storm, some radar activity on our part, that just overwhelmed their their awareness, right? Their local awareness of what was going on, and they crashed. So it's possible. So that memo could easily be true.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember, there's this outstanding, what is it, like 4.5 hour long interview with Nancy. Do you remember this? And she was actually telepathically being interviewed and interviewing the one survivor.
Yeah, that was a nurse.
Right.
Yeah, I can't speak.
I just remember in that interview, supposedly, they mentioned that there was something about they got caught in a net, some sort of electrical, you know, electromagnetic net. Anyway, it just confirms
that I can really respond to. It's outside my strike zone.
Now, how about this? And I'm not sure if this is something you're aware of. It says, in the citizens' hearings, they talked about a statement that was made where we needed to develop a new series of equations. Do you remember this?
That might have been me. I like to use that phrase.
Well, can you suggest what that would be and what are we tossing out?
That's a very big subject. It's primarily a worldview statement.
Okay.
And it applies a little bit more to governmental policies and the worldview of governments, which is really a collective worldview. You call it your foreign and domestic policy, as it is, say, with individuals. So you could still apply it to individuals. So what I mean by that is that the governments of nations, every single day, are working sets of equations. They're addressing groups of variables that apply to the oil issue, environmental issue, every relationship they have with every other country, some of which are trivial, some of which are hugely complex, and on and on and on. Each of these relationships, each of these issues, have their own sets of variables, and they're solving these equations. And you know, you could have a set of variables in one equation, and you can have the same set of variables in a whole different equation. This is true of physics, right?
Right.
So there are equations that involve mass and energy and frequency, all kind of stuff. And in a certain equation, they give you one result. In another equation, they give you another result. It depends on what you're looking for. What has happened is that the worldview of governments, of the managers of social contracts, is no longer... The world has changed, and the equations they're using will not give them an answer that will produce the results that they want. And so they have to change their worldview. And what that means is devising new equations in which to work with those variables, so they will give results that are helpful. And they haven't been able to do it. In fact, it's remarkable to watch since 1964, which I believe is the turning point,
oh my God,
how these equations have failed over and over and over again to advance the collective human condition and the welfare of not a single nation, but all nations. We've had a few things that we managed to pull off, though not surprisingly, took too long and too much effort, again, because we had the wrong equation. It's like having to sweep out the house, but you got a short broom. It's not long enough, and so you're able to do it, but it takes three times as long and breaks your back.
Wow.
So, a clock is right twice a day. Stop clock is right twice a day. So, we have to change the equation. Well, let me tell you, that is difficult. Right? You know, a human being who also has a worldview that is not working, read a good book, find a new relationship, have an insight, change your worldview, and your life can completely change. And you turn things around. It happens. Not easy, though. Right? If it was easy, everybody would be turning their life around.
Exactly.
When you're talking about governments, when you're talking about major powers, it is brutal. And so we have continued to sail right towards the waterfall. and haven't been able to steer the canoe away from it. And now we're heading right over. And it's not one of those small ones. It's a big drop.
Yeah.
So unless we have this worldview change, I think we're screwed. Well, there is only one candidate in the world today that has the leverage to change worldview at the governmental level. Nothing else even remotely comes close. And that is formal acknowledgement of the extraterrestrial presence, the disclosure event, which it's possible, don't need to do it now, to intellectually show why that is a worldview changer, a game changer, that will allow us to reboot our operating system, right? It actually has the power to shut down, not shut down, but allow us to, quote, suspend the current operating system, the worldview we're working on, reboot it with a better software, with ability to solve equations in a better way. And in that post-disclosure world, I believe we will find the ability to deal with these problems finally before it's too late. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
So obviously, just saying we need to change the equations.
A lot more to it than that. So can you also expound upon the sundown rule that they described and discussed in the citizens' hearings about the classified files and their expiration date?
Sunset rule.
I thought it was sundown.
There are a, well, it might have been sundown. It could have been sundown. I, either way, it's the same. Look, with respect to government documents, there are different, there are various laws that apply to them. And there's a number of different laws. And depends on the documents, depends on where they came from. And generally, these laws have time frames in which the documents can be held classified and then could be released. Fine. Of course, the government violates those time frames all the time. But you know, it does demonstrate an effort to increase transparency. Usually the time frames are long enough so all the culprits will be dead. It's really all about saving your ass. It's all about CYA. It's, oh, well, we wouldn't want that to come out right away because somebody made a couple. No, it's about being able to do stuff and not have to face the consequences in many cases, in most cases. And the people have seen through this finally. They're kind of fed up with it. So Edward Snowden, bless his heart, I guess you could say he wasn't buying into the sundown rule. He released several hundred thousand documents.
Yes.
Ahead of schedule. By and large, the American people said, good. That should be a huge message to the United States government, which is very thick-headed, and it may take a while for that message to get through their big skull.
It still was a dramatic effect on the planet. Dramatic effect.
Big deal, milestone event, coupled with Wikipedia actions.
Yeah.
And now the thing is, what's the government going to do about it? How are they going to respond? We really haven't gotten a full response yet, because the government is trying to decide what to do and what we might, how we might react. So we're, and it's just one of the many watershed moments that we're facing. Tipping points, watershed moments, milestone moments, and the decisions we make at these kinds of moments will determine the 21st century. And right now, I don't have much confidence in, how would you say, the judgment of those who are remain in power.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, you know, a lot of people are wondering about this regarding you because you're walking a very murky pathway in this particular field of black ops programs, government officials, politicians, anybody to do with anything that has to do with secret space programs and all that stuff. And I've always wondered, how do you make sure that the people that you're contacting or aligning with to get this off the ground are trustworthy? Because there's so many, you know, CIA operatives and people that you can't totally trust. I mean, you're walking a line where it's very fuzzy because the actual people that you're pulling forth to do the testimony are the same ones possibly that have already taken those oaths to keep things secretive.
Well, look, really we're talking about witnesses. How do you deal with witnesses? I don't call them whistleblowers, but witnesses. Because again, basic policy is legal. You don't whistleblow legal policy. You hear witnesses to government action.
That right there is a total difference. So I see what you're saying.
Well, yeah. That's really what matters. In terms of colleagues and other researchers, you use your judgment. I mean, you just, some people you have high confidence in, some people you don't.
Well, I mean, people are just amazed you're still alive.
No. Should be. They shouldn't be amazed. There are good reasons why. Look, I've never been bothered at all. All of the problems I have had have not come from the government. They've come from people in the field. So I understand why that is.
Yeah.
Here's how I deal with witnesses. And this is very much a response, very much affected by the realities of this issue, which is the truth embargo, right? You know, there are a lot of people out there that just want to pretend that there's no truth embargo and then try to make decisions about this and that and everything else. And it's not going to work. It's like trying to solve an equation with one variable completely missing. It's supposed to be there. You'll never get an answer. So and within respect to the truth embargo, 68 years of obfuscation, misdirection, and interference, and so forth, right? And intimidations and other things. Here's how we deal with my soul. Anybody that comes forward with testimony about what they've seen, heard, done while serving in government or politics, is, as far as I'm concerned, fully legitimate until proven otherwise. Okay. Now you say, well, how do you prove otherwise? Well, let me make it clear. This advocacy movement has very little funding. It's almost impossible to get serious funding for this movement. It's probably the least funded major advocacy movement in all of history, and that is a direct result of the truth embargo. All right? So do we have the hundreds of thousands of dollars it would take to do extensive background checks on scores and scores of witnesses? Not even close. Not to mention the fact, when you're dealing with government people, you can't get to their files. Particularly if they do have a classified one, you're going to do. You might find out if they've had parking tickets. So you assume. And one of the, you give them legitimacy until something develops that convinces you that they're problematic. But there's another reason for that. People that are going to come forward on this issue, whether or not they're violating security laws or non-disclosure agreements, which they feel due to their advanced age or years of retirement don't apply anymore or not, deserve default respect. You respect these people. You don't treat them like some problematic witness that turns up to a murder case or something and could mess up the case. And so you work them over in the interrogation room.
Absolutely.
Right? Or maybe put them under arrest as witness arrest, right? You do that, and you're sending a message to everybody in government: don't come out.
Well, of course.
You're like crap.
Yeah.
So automatic respect. Then, over time, right, they will present. They will talk. You'll be able to get a sense of whether you have high confidence in that person. Because oftentimes these testimonies interlock, right? Perfect example. One of the most important issues today is nuclear weapons tampering. Now, if there was only one Air Force officer that had come forward with this testimony, that would be one thing. So you would assess that testimony based on that. Doesn't mean you dismiss it. You've got 20 or more. So in terms of that testimony, total confidence. Now, it's possible that one of those people is giving the same testimony, was never even there. They just want to be part of the game. Fine. Is that going to undermine the act? No, it's not.
Not at all.
So that's the first, that's one fundamental principle. And then the other area of how I select witnesses is that some issues, some areas are much more important than others. Some testimonies are much more relevant to the advocacy process than others. So it's just not anybody that's had an experience, anybody that's seen something while working for NASA. That doesn't mean, oh yeah, yeah, you put that in the file. You're looking for the witnesses that have testimony, defensive evidence, that are very powerful in terms of moving the advocacy process forward. That's how I make the selection. That's how I chose those people.
So ultimately, that's the connecting Pat link right there, is having the motivation to get the advocacy movement moving forward.
Well, it's not necessarily their motivation, but rather the nature of their testimony, what they're addressing. Does it have power to advance the advocacy movement, whether they're motivated or not?
Okay.
And if it doesn't, that doesn't mean we don't treat them with respect. It doesn't mean that we, you know, just toss them aside. It just means, in terms of what I'm doing, I'm going to go for those witnesses, because all of those stories will have their place in time. Post-disclosure world, everybody with a story, with testimony, is going to want to be heard, and people will want to hear their story. Right now, it's all about getting disclosure.
So
each of those witnesses was there because I had a sufficient level of confidence in that everything they were going to say, by and large, was going to be relevant, legitimate. Did I prove that? No. Does that mean that there weren't some things said at that citizen hearing that were probably either off the wall or will definitely prove untrue? Not at all. I think there were some things. That wasn't much. And so, as far as I'm concerned, that was the most powerful assemblage of testimony and witnesses ever brought together.
Very cool. So do you think it's true that the MJ-12 are desiring full disclosure as well?
I have heard from people.
Yeah, me too.
From people that within government, within those areas that are appropriate, there is a majority view the disclosure should have. Okay? However, this is not a democratic process. It's taking a vote. All right. If there are still a number that are opposed to it and they raise the objections, then that is a significant barrier. More importantly, the military intelligence complex cannot disclose the ET presence. They work for the President of the United States. Any unilateral action in that regard from them is high treason.
Mm-hmm.
Right? End of career, constitutional crisis. And so just because there may be a consensus, unless some sort of deal can be struck with the executive branch, which requires them to reach out.
There would be a piggy right there.
They're not going to be able to do anything. But the fact that, and if it's true, that a majority actually favors intellectual disclosure, that's one more item on the list of why disclosure is inevitable.
Yeah, good point. Well, now, some people want to know, what do you know to be the actual security restraints that are implemented by the military intelligence complex, preventing folks from stepping forward?
This is the most highly classified issue in the government. And so you've got a certain number of people that are working directly on this subject, on this issue in government.
Okay.
And your security clearances are ultra tight. You can count on that.
Yeah.
Lifetime ban on revealing anything, all right? Draconian penalties. Then you've got people that are in outside that circle that have some interaction with it, some awareness. That are under non-disclosure agreements as well, maybe not quite as severe. There's different kinds, different levels of classification. Some are lifetime, some are X number of years. And all of these apply. And if you violate them, there are consequences. And, you know, the fact is, if you've got the higher up somebody is, the more money they're making, the more they have to lose. Government workers generally are family people, vast majority of them, spouses and children, all of which would suffer not to mention it's, you know, against the law, et cetera. So these basic tenets. Now, in the case of witnesses, they've been known to threaten. Researchers, they've been known to threaten, not so much. So these are part of, this is part of the truth embargo. Now, since 2000, that's changing. I am not aware of any significant interference with witnesses since 2000.
Wow.
I've never been interfered with since 96. Now, part of the reason is I didn't get in until 96. Things were changing, right? Though, from 96, 97, 98, 99, early 99, some very unpleasant things were happening. Let's just say they went through a reactionary period. But because I was so new, they didn't bother with me. They bothered some other people, but not me. And then 2000, things start to change. But it's also the case, the way I've approached the issue, I deliberately planned a strategy and approach to this that would not unduly antagonize the government.
Yeah. Right? I noticed that. That was a smart move on your
part. What's to be gained
making
enemies with a state that has nuclear weapons?
Right.
There's no upside to that. And so, you know, I can get on their case, but no. And the other, another reason for that is that we know that there are plenty of people in government that probably are on our side, right, that can't join up. I mean, we're not going to leave the government, join the posse. But they're on our side. And so if you're antagonizing, if you're really demonizing the government, then you are demonizing them too, right? So that's not good.
Right.
Secondly, I made the commitment from day one, everything in the open.
Good for you.
Don't do anything, no encrypting, don't care about the phone, tap me all you want. Pretty much say what I'm gonna do before I do it. So there's no paranoia.
Yeah.
Minimizing the paranoia the government might have, but what was he going to do? They like that.
Yeah, big time.
Here's a wonderful little example. A number of years ago, I got pulled over for speeding in the Bethesda area, right? And it was about 10 o'clock. Pulled me over, and I know what to do in situations. First thing I did is I put my hands out, put my arm up on the seat, put my other hand on the car door thing. So he saw my hands very early,
right?
And so he recognized I was doing that, so not to make his job easier and reduce his paranoia.
Yeah.
Then of course I was nice.
Of course.
I didn't give any shit. Actually, I was speeding too, by the way, about 10 miles over the speed
limit. Is that
he gave me a warning ticket. Okay? Get it?
Yeah. No, okay. I totally get it.
So that is the reason, I believe, that and the timing is the reason I've never been bothered. Now that could change tomorrow. But if it does, I'll go on coast to coast immediately.
Sounds like you made the right choice. Now, one of the other things that I wanted you to go into more detail is the contactees' accounts are indicating that regarding they being a part of a transition process that is underway leading to disclosure and possibly followed by open contact. What do you seem to find as the common variable amongst all the contactees that you've spoken to? As far as what they're receiving, the information that they're receiving regarding disclosure and the transition process?
Well, first of all, in terms of the transition model and open contact, that's me. All right, that's my assessment.
You, baby, huh?
Yeah, that's where you heard that.
Okay.
In terms of contactees, you have a range, a pretty complex range of interpretations. Everybody is looking into that personal filter. And of course, the events themselves are complicated. You've got memory issues, you've got all kinds of stuff. One of the common threads the contactees, if they're getting cable work done, is they don't like it. Mm. And they resent it. So there's one.
Interesting.
Contactees are frequently given images and messages during a visit, oftentimes following cable work. These messages seem to have a theme. They're shown images of environmental destruction, war, bad things.
Yes.
Some interpret that as a threat. Some interpret that as a message. Some believe it's the future. They're actually being shown the future before that. I would say, though, that if there is a consensus emerging out of the contactee world, which includes people that are not having cable, and it also includes people that are having alleged flanking, mental, is that there is a process underway that is leading somewhere, right? And I think the consensus is also that this process is leading to someplace, okay. Now, what percentage of contactees are in that line? I don't. And with so many of them still in the closet,
yes,
we're dealing with a limited sample. We're dealing with, you know, what distinguishes this group is the fact that they're public at all. So that is a defined group, those willing to be public. So who knows what the overall feeling is and knowledge is of those who have not been public.
You said something really interesting about how the contactees are one of the very last groups of people to come out of the closet.
Absolutely.
You know, and I thought, wow, that's interesting.
If you look at the large groups, large substantial size groups, they're the last. Okay? The gays are definitely out of the closet. The ones that are still in there, it's purely for convenience. They're out, they're forming politically, they're getting bills passed, they're winning victories, you know, rapidly. Being gay is just no longer a big deal anymore.
That's true.
Now, but are they fully out of the closet? No, but for you know, all intents and purposes, that we're moving out of that phase. So, you know, there was a time when Jews were in the closet, right?
Right.
There was
Christians, way back thousands of years.
Back far enough, Christians were in the closet. So, you know, this is a very significant factor in the human experience within social contracts.
Yes.
Closeted people. Now, we're smart enough now to know that you don't want this. This is not appropriate under a social contract, period. All right, we get that. And that's why, again, we're pretty much out of closets. Save one. Contact these. This is a tough closet. Okay, why? Take a gay 1955. Maybe they're in the entertainment business, whatever. But whatever business they're in, they know that if they were to be openly gay, they would affect them. It could cost them their job, limit their options, and so forth. They feel it.
Yeah.
We know that a lot of the actors actually had beards. They had women, say it was men, they would have a girlfriend who, in fact, you know, that was there for show. So they're in the club, unable to be open. But, and they're in there, and they're gay. But the government was not going around telling people year after year after year, like Ahmadinejad, that there are no gays. They don't exist in our country. They're somewhere else. And so you're not only in the closet, unable to be who you are,
yeah,
and say who you are, but your own government is telling all of your fellow countrymen, you don't exist. At least gays don't exist. Now that is a serious closet.
Yes.
That's the closet the contactees are in. The White House just stated 3 years ago, there's no evidence at all for any extraterrestrial presence. So they're contactees, they can't talk about it, and the government says that entities that they're dealing with don't exist. This is not cool.
No.
So they've got a doubly tough time. Now, they're slowly coming out, but they're nowhere near where the gays are. But I'll make you a prediction right now.
Ah, good.
The day will come. I seriously don't think it will be pre-disclosure. Well, because one thing, I want disclosure right now. They don't have time. So it'll probably be post-disclosure. But the day will come. Contactees are going to not be out of the closet. They're going to be fully politicizing themselves. And they're going to exert substantial political influence. Okay? Now, post-disclosure, that influence is going to be more along the lines of policy, post-disclosure policy. Because post-disclosure, not only they're not going to be in the closet, they're going to be on everybody's invite list.
Yeah.
Okay? Very popular people.
Yeah.
Meaning, if you're holding a party in Georgetown and you're inviting a lot of hotshots over and you don't have some contactees there, you're finished, right? Your social life is finished, right? Where's the contactees? So that's not going to be the problem. Where the politics come in is they have more firsthand knowledge about the ETs than anybody else. And so if the U.S. government wants to do stupid policies regarding ETs in the post-disclosure world, look for the contactees to politically come together and exert the kind of influence the gays are exerting now. Now, if they somehow were able to come out of the closet pre-disclosure, meaning we don't get it this year, a couple of years will go on, the stupidity continues to advance, it's possible enough will be out of the closet that they will politicize. And you'll have gays holding press conferences, I mean not gays, but contactees holding press conferences and making some really powerful waves, all right, which would help the disclosure process. But I doubt it, only because the era of the contactee, the modern era of the contactee, is only about 30 years, a little more than 30 years. The gays have been struggling with their closet thing for much, much longer.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a little, it would be remarkable for the contactees, particularly given the truth embargo,
right,
to move forward that quickly. But you are starting to see the early stages of it. And pay attention, if you look for it, you will start to see politicization of contactees.
Interesting. Cool. I look forward to that for sure.
I'm sure you'll be part of it.
Yeah. So now you had also mentioned that the extraterrestrials are not a threat to the human society and the future of the human society.
Not a threat.
Okay. And my question to you is, how do we know which extraterrestrials we're talking about? The reason I say that is because my audience has gone miles and miles and miles down into the rabbit hole about all the conspiracy and all of the alternative ways of seeing the government, the way that they operate behind closed doors. And there's a very clear schism of the military-related ETs and the extraterrestrials that are actually here for our benevolent support. So what do you I'd like to hear you comment on that.
Okay. Well, as far as the extraterrestrial engagement, in terms of assessing its future outcomes, you need to do a collective assessment, because they're working together. It's obvious. Plenty of evidence for that. They're working together. So they have arrangements, alliances. Does that surprise anybody?
No.
Of course not. And so collectively, now on an individual basis, it's possible that one of the individual species, their ultimate intentions would be considered a little more sour and a little more problematic. But that individual intention is not what will prevail. The collective intention will prevail. So that's the first point. Second point, military. My lab.
Right.
This is nasty business.
Very.
I've heard enough, talked to enough people to believe it is true.
Agreed.
And what I believe is true is that, now I'm giving you a speculative model, okay?
Okay.
I believe military abductions take place. what I'm about to say now is a speculative interpretation because I don't know for sure. But nobody knows. But it appears that the obviously the government is fully aware and has been for a very long time of contact, right? They know that. Of course, if only because based on the percentages, there are plenty of people, you know, in the Pentagon and in the intelligence that are contactees.
That's true.
They don't. You know, it's not like they have an off limits for the military. The intelligence. If you're in the genetic line, you're in play. So they know about it.
That's so true.
And admittedly, you know, within their own ranks, I suppose, assuming that person came forward, which may or may not be a good idea, they might be able to garner some information. But let's assume that there is a limited amount there, that it's not even. So if you're the government, if you're the military or the intelligence, and you want to know more about what the ETs are doing here, well, you've got several options. One, send them an email and say, "What's up, guys?" Well, that's not going to happen. Or you could go to contactees' homes, introduce yourself, and say, "Hello, I'm Major so-and-so from the Air Force. We know that you're in contact with extraterrestrials. We'd like you to, could you talk to us about that? We'd like to know what's going on." No, you can't do that. Because then they basically announce to this person, "Of course, we know all about the ETs." Now, you do that about 50 times, and you've got some problems. All right? So you can't do that. So what do? They take a contactee, an uncontactee. They grab them. They take them and they interrogate them under very powerful which they have been perfecting for a long time. And they pump them for information. And then they, using these same drugs, they apparently, with some success, are able to leave that person with either a blackout of the event or a false memory. Usually that memory is along the lines of, "This was another ET abduction."
Right.
Nasty business. This is one of those PR problems the government's going to have post-disclosure. This is one of the reasons why when they're chatting about the disclosure potential, somebody is always going to raise their hand and say, "You know, sounds good, but you do know we're going to have to answer to this, don't you?"
Yes.
Okay, so, but then that leaves one other matter, and that is that some have claimed ETs are working with our military in the questions. Well, it's interesting. If that is true, meaning, you know, the ETs abducted you, and it's easier for them to do that than us, right? And then we are able to, we're involved, and for whatever reason, we're gaining something from being there present. That's an even bigger public relations problem.
Yeah.
Okay? Really big public relations problem. Except, well, not except, but in that area, I'm remaining still pretty neutral. And there are a couple of reasons. We got to be really careful on this one. Because of the public relations implications, it's important that we withhold judgment until we have absolute solid proof about this. And why? Well, the extraterrestrials, we do know, have extremely sophisticated ability to manipulate human minds, right? They can erase your memory. They can freeze you in place. They can put in false memory. And so the simple thing, the fact is that if you're in the middle of an abduction and the extraterrestrials that are dealing with you want you to see the entire, you know, Joint Chiefs of Staff, that's what you see.
Absolutely.
And so it's possible that the military figures that are seen in these events are, in fact, screen memories, not real military. That one thing alone means I've got to withhold judgment on this until we know a lot more. It's also possible that the military person that there was also a contactee and has been abducted as well. Right? So, I mean, we're getting deep into the rabbit hole here, aren't we? Guess what? The history of this phenomena is extraordinarily complicated.
Yes.
And made even more complicated by the truth embargo. And unless someone respects that degree of complication and respects the effects of the truth embargo, they're going to get tangled up, follow some, maybe go up some blind canyon, and maybe even go around in circles. It is not easy to address and deal with this issue.
Well, I know that there was some sort of agreement apparently made between the government and the extraterrestrials regarding the abductions and actually doing, human bodies. Yeah. You know, analysis and experiments and things like that. But I've also heard through the grapevine that that was supposedly to be halted. Have you heard anything?
First of all, how do you know there was an agreement?
Well, it's just there's so much information out there. You're right. I mean, I wasn't personally there, but I have a lot of friends that are contactees.
Yeah, but wait a minute. So are you saying that contactees have told you this?
I've had contactees tell me some interesting stories.
Well, but I mean, have you had contactees tell you that there was an agreement between our government and extraterrestrials regarding technology swap for access?
Well, it wasn't that detailed, but some of them have picked up on that when they've been regressed. And there's the problem right there, is that they don't remember what happened at the time. It's not until later that their lives are all screwed up and they have to go back and get regression therapy to even remember what's causing all the, you know, pain and suffering in their life to begin with.
Okay, well, that's the individual contactee's dilemma. Let me make an obvious point. This is what happens, particularly in a truth embargo setting. Right? Someone puts out, based upon whatever they have seen, a thread. In this case, the thread is the Eisenhower meeting, based upon certain evidence. Other people pick it up like that. And so they tell other people. They blog it. They put it in thread. Somebody else turns up, maybe saw something that, if that is true, what they saw seems to connect, and they put it out. And after a number of years, you got a whole lot of people talking about Eisenhower meeting, when in fact, the actual fundamental genesis is one person. This is another serious problem. I'm aware of most of the hard evidence for the Eisenhower meeting, and it has not been proven. More importantly, even if there was a meeting, it hasn't been proven what happened with that meeting. It's also possible that he didn't go to meet with anybody. He went to simply see it, either the live one or some of the dead ones, right? I mean, that would make sense too.
Yeah.
So we don't know if there's a treaty. Now, why does that matter? Look, well, it matters for this reason. The advocacy movement to get the truth embargo and the position of the government and all this stuff coming together is not easy. And if they... false theory is out there in which the government is you know, matter-of-factly accused of cutting a deal with extraterrestrials for technology they never got, so the ETs could have unencumbered access to human beings to experiment. That's a non-trivial matter. That seriously impacts the ability to resolve this issue. Now, if it's true, it is true. And, you know, let the chips fall where they may.
Right.
But if it's not true, it's a problem. And I, you know, if I'm going to be able to advocate for this, I got to work from truth. You know, it's like, take the civil rights movement. There was a famous case in the civil rights movement when three civil rights activists, I think it was three, it might have been four, were murdered in Mississippi, buried in a landfill. And this generated a great deal of intensity and response. But if the case had been that no, that never happened, so these people weren't killed, or the people that were allegedly killed never existed and the whole story was false, that wouldn't have helped the civil rights movement.
No.
Would have undermined it. All right? So it was important that whatever things were happening that were dealt with and people were responding to in that movement and any other movement needed to be true. All right? Integrity is very important in advocacy movements. Right? You already know the government in almost every case is not integrous on this. Right? So to the extent that you maintain your integrity, you have a significant and important advantage. Right? So, and I, you know, this is a long answer to what's a simple question, was there a meeting? But it's not, you know, the Eisenhower case is not the only historical data point that's suspect or not proven yet. There's a lot of them, right? And I just want people to keep that in mind as they slog through this. And another thing I usually say is that with some confidence, I can say that at least half of everything on the internet and in books written about this subject will prove to be wrong. Doesn't mean that it's all nefariously wrong. Doesn't mean that it's, some of it's clearly government disinformation. Yeah, that's part of it.
Right.
So that's kind of nefarious. It'll simply be proven to be wrong. And that's worth remembering.
Yeah.
Right? Okay? Yeah. So, you know, the principal task, right, that any researcher, any advocate has, right, that's dealing with this issue, is to devote a considerable amount of their time to assessing everything that comes across their radar and trying to assess its validity to the best that they can and its usefulness, and stay away from the stuff that is problematic and simply do not embrace, right, anything that turns up. It's not easy to do. And some people don't care. They just, to them, it's just something that they follow, they're interested in. It's maybe even entertainment to them. It doesn't matter to them. They're going to grab anything that comes through, and who's to say they shouldn't? They're not a researcher. They're simply a spectator, and they're enjoying it. It's a hobby, right?
Yep.
And there's a lot of people in that zone. And so that ensures that a lot of this stuff that's problematic is always going to be floating in there, right?
Yep.
And that just makes the job a little harder, but that's the hand that's dealt.
We've all been talking lately about how there's so many lies upon lies upon lies upon lies,
mm-hmm.
that nobody even knows what's true anymore, especially those of us that have been delving into all of this. And I'm not just talking about the military or, you know, truth embargo or anything like that, but really we've all come to the conclusion that, you know, everything is a lie. And so...
I know, well, come on now. That's not
you know,
fair.
I mean, seriously, there's so much information out there that is continually being proven to not be that, which especially that we were brought up to believe.
Well, of course.
And the only thing I'm saying is that same premise, as you're pointing out, applies to that preconceived notion that we all have, many, many, many of us have, about the government, about the military, that, you know, they haven't been here for our benefit. And what you're doing is you're just making us aware that we have to apply that same principle to that level of government as we do with everything else that we read and research. So
I think, fair enough. I think the proper statement you want to make is that a significant number of people in our society now cannot determine what is true or false about a lot of things. There are still, there is a certain number of people that are so, well, they're very smart, they're very informed, very knowledgeable, and they're able to pretty much figure out what's true and what's not with a fairly high degree of accuracy, but they're a very small minority. You've got a lot of people that don't care one way or the other. Right. Now, the fact is, the percentage of people in our society right now that are increasingly unable to determine the truth from falsehood with respect to government issues, including the extraterrestrial issue, is at a percentage that is dangerous. It's way, it's too high. I mean, you're never, it's never going to be zero, believe me, but it's way too high. And thus, it's a threat to our society. And by and large, the government is principally responsible for this.
Yes.
Period. And that's another thing that people in the field don't get. They keep forgetting about the government and just putting that aside and then reacting to stuff and other people in the field based upon the absence of that factor.
Right.
Big mistake. All right? And so...
Good point.
When people get things wrong, you know, or when people do something stupid in this field, and let me tell you, this truth embargo makes fools of us all. And nobody that escapes the truth embargo's consequences. To one degree or another, makes a fool of everybody. When something like that happens, rather than want to jump down that person's throat, I just remind myself repeatedly that this person is a victim of the truth embargo.
That's...
And show a certain...
Well, and they have the capacity technologically. You know, you've got your trolls. You've got the capability to get into people's computers, into their emails. They can, I mean, they have so much access to technology that we don't even know about.
Oh, yeah, there's that. There's so many ways they can mess with us. And
yeah, there's just so many things that they can do and still do to create, I see it all the time, to create dissension amongst even those of us that should be in union, working together. And that's the whole reason I brought this up, by the way. So
we're never going to have a broad-based coalition in this field pursuing the truth on this. It's never going to happen. The truth embargo is so... It's been so effective.
Yes, it has.
It can't happen. Now, you may say, well, I don't know. It happens in other fields. Yeah. The civil rights movement developed a pretty broad-based, substantial advocacy movement that did have its breakoffs and its dissensions, but it was pretty broad-based, opposing segregation in the South and got the Civil Rights Act in 64. But the United States government hadn't instituted a decades-long policy of propaganda and misinformation to convince large segments of the population and the press that there was no segregation in the South, that that was fact was an illusion. There really is no segregation down there. What are you complaining about?
And throwing trillions of dollars at it, too.
Well, not trillions, but spending a lot of money to completely confuse everybody.
Yeah.
They didn't do that, and so a coalition could be brought together. And this issue, the government's position still to this day, and only put in writing for the first time in 2011, November the 4th, is there's no evidence for any of it. And so, and then, of course, they're messing with the field. So there's never going to be that broad base. And so everybody that's upset about that needs to understand it ain't going to happen. And so just accept that. And those that want to get on the bandwagon, those that want to get on the train, will get on, and those that can't, won't. That we don't have to have a huge phalanx of deeply cooperating people and groups, even if we can afford it, which we can't, to get this done. Don't. We're doing just fine. Well, we're doing pretty good right now. It's moving along.
Yeah, we are. I think we're doing really well right now. So now to kind of segue against that conversation, away from that conversation. Now, there was a really aggressive closure of military bases in the early 90s.
Right.
And do you attribute this? Does this line up with the end of the Cold War?
Yeah, sort of.
Was there anything? I'm just curious, like, do you think that this was catalyzed by anything to do with the truth embargo?
Oh, God knows. The truth embargo is a massive variable, and I'm sure it's a factor in a whole ton of stuff that may not be acknowledged. The base closures was mostly driven by economics. A lot of pressure in the budget, and the progressives were, you know, they had some leverage, and so and the Pentagon wanted to, the Pentagon doesn't, you know, go out of its way to waste money. I mean, really, they had other things to spend money on, so they closed a lot of the bases that were not necessary. And we made some other bases. The fact is, so I think that was not a particularly meaningful event. Okay.
I was just curious because you've heard the information about how they're using a lot of these bases for the very subject that we brought up, which is like my labs, you know.
They don't need to close down bases to play games like that. Look, I've been to some of these things. You know, they're converted into business parks and stuff. The base where I was born, Mare Island Naval Hospital, right, is a converted closed base. No, it wasn't for that purpose. They got plenty of underground facilities. They got them all over the place. They don't. Now, admittedly, if they close a base down, then usually the property gets reused. You know, you got some people up there mucking around. You don't want an entrance to an underground facility there. No. But here's the reality. As of 2009, the United States was spending more money on its military and defense than all of the rest of the nations in the world put together. Now, which is incomprehensible. We have over 1,000 some bases around the world. We still have 5,800 nuclear weapons. As of 2014, because of the economic collapse, right, that was triggered by the Republicans in 2008, our growth has slowed some. And so right now, our spending is the equivalent of the next 8 countries. Okay, and let me really put that in perspective. A lot of people will be shocked to hear this. The United States, as of 2015, is spending about $570 billion on its defense, military, and secret operations. And it's probably more than that because a lot of the secret funding is not disclosed.
Yes.
So the Russia is spending $17 billion. The great bear, the great threat, the United States is being outspent 35-1. Right. And yet we're doing everything we can to irritate them, encroach, push them, to the point where we've now got the basis for a new confrontation and possible Cold War. This is what I mean by wrong equations.
Yeah.
All right? And so, we closed a few bases, but trust me, the trillions are still pouring down that hole.
God.
And one of the reasons for that, by the way, that justifies this internally, is the ET issue. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, the Cold War was over, but the ETs haven't gone anywhere. And so internally, you always get some people saying, you know, just in case, we really got to, you know, keep building those weapons, you know, because you never know, we may have to fight those ETs. So it's a big justification for maintaining massive military presence. And, you know, the way they think, I mean, I could go give some briefing at the Pentagon, not that I'm invited, and I could spend hours making a very powerful case that it's an utter waste of money, right? Because anybody that knows anything about physics would know right now, that we haven't a snowball's chance of dealing successfully in a military engagement with extraterrestrials. We wouldn't have a chance. Oh. All of those movies where we win in the end, completely fiction, nonsense,
yeah.
Okay? And if somehow, over a period of time, We started to develop technological weapons so powerful that we could be a threat to them. And they cared. They would just take us out before we had a chance to build them. So it's all an old equation being solved over and over again that cannot give you the right answer. And so our country slowly falls apart. Bridges, roads, environment, education system, medical system, health system, while we spend more money on defense and the military than the next eight nations combined. And we think that somehow that's going to work out okay.
That's crazy. So what I want to talk to you also about is the Obama administration. And
why not?
So this is a little bit of a long question, but there's a purpose for it. So bear with me.
I give long answers. It's okay for you to give long questions.
So you've stated many, many times in your interviews that you had provided a disclosure petition to the White House back in 2011.
Rarely miss an opportunity.
And you generated a response from the Obama administration, and the response was basically that the U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet or that an extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race. And in addition, there is no credible information to suggest that any evidence is being hidden from the public's eye. Okay, so that's number one. Probably
the most bogus paragraph ever written by any government in history.
Yes. And then number two is John Podesta, who admitted through a personal tweet that his biggest regret was leaving the administration with unfinished UFO business. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but just recently last month, Obama came on the Kimmel show. Are you familiar with that? But one of the comments that was made was when he asked Obama if he had looked at Area 51 and UFOs, Obama's comment was, "The aliens won't let it happen. You will reveal all of their secrets. They exercise strict control over us," unquote.
All said with a half of his tongue in his cheek.
So my point is, and there's more and more. I mean, supposedly he's the first president to actually publicly mention Area 51. Clinton supposedly made reference to it, but he actually mentioned it. And I think my question is, isn't this a little bit of soft disclosure?
It's more than that.
Okay. Curious what you think.
Okay, all right, here we go. Get ready.
I'm getting ready.
Okay, I mean, you've given me the door to basically give your vast audience a quick summation of the status of the Congressional Hearing Initiative.
Awesome.
Okay. The Congressional Hearing Initiative was supposed to launch in November of 2013. But after the citizen hearing was over, a lot of stuff went wrong. And that's just life. Things went wrong. So it was delayed. Eventually, I made an announcement, probably in late January or about, in which I announced that we would launch the Congressional Hearing Initiative on March the 31st. Okay? And what that meant was, is that on March the 31st, we would ship, of 2014, we would ship the full 30-hour record of the citizen hearing with all that testimony to every member of Congress, every congressional office, accompanied by a letter signed by the witness, calling for hearings, calling for them to review that DVD material and meet with me, the registered lobbyist for PRG. Now, as it happens, on the very first day of the citizen hearing, afternoon session, 3 hours, it was on the Rockefeller Initiative. And the Rockefeller Initiative was the three-year effort by billionaire Lawrence Rockefeller to convince President Clinton to release all of the UFO files in the government possession and grant amnesty to witnesses that might come forward. In other words, spill everything, spill the bean, which would have triggered disclosure. It would have resulted in disclosure. We know this because we have 1,000 pages of documents via FOIA obtained signed by Grant Cameron in 2000. So we know all about it. Plus, many of the researchers that were involved still alive. So what happened was, in 2000, late 2000, maybe early 2001, Grant Cameron got those thousand pages of files, sent me a copy. I made a couple of copies and handed the whole set over to USA Today newspaper and the Washington Post. We did absolutely nothing.
Oh.
And Grant put the files up on his website. About a year and a half later, I put the files up on my website, along with a lot of other material on paradigmresearchgroup.org, and then talked about it repeatedly, sent faxes to the Congress. Anybody could have gone and seen it. Okay? Nothing. Okay. Now, why is this important? Very important. Right? What happened is that a major funder of the Democratic Party, a friend of the president and his wife, initiated an initiative that went on for 3 years of meetings, reports, letters, and the people that knew about it was the president, his wife, who I think her name is Hillary, his key advisor, John Podesta, his chief of staff, Leon Panetta, his very close vice president, Albert Ford, and another very close friend, political colleague who became his Secretary of Energy, Bill Richardson. Went on for 3 years. The press never covered it. One story was written in the New York Post by Deborah Orme, who's now deceased. That was it. Didn't cover it. And in the 22 years since it began, none of those six people I have mentioned has ever uttered a single word about it or ever been asked a single question about it. Interesting.